So I'll be talking about linear and nonlinear resonance problems, first in general and then getting a bit more specific. I want to mention my co-workers on various aspects of the work I'll discuss. Avi Sofer from Rutgers, Edward Kier at University of Chicago. Together, Roy Goodman, Phil Holmes, and Dick Slusher, Roy at New Jersey Institute of Technology, Phil at Princeton, and Dick Slusher's head of optical physics at Bell Labs, Peter Miller, also at University of Michigan, and recently some work with Russell Jackson, who's at Boston University. So the rough sketch of my talk is as follows. I'll give some examples of resonance problems, linear and nonlinear resonance problems, say something about the phenomena. I'll focus for a little while on the problem of trapping solitons in media with defects. So you have some coherent pulse of light, for example, it's propagating through a nonlinear media, and you try to create some kind of potholes which will trap the energy, some way to actually stop light or stop some transfer energy into the natural modes of the defect. And one of the things that you see when you analyze the asymptotics, the time asymptotics, what happens to the energy, how does the energy distribute after a while, is that you see that there's a kind of selection of the ground state, that energy wants to settle into the a natural ground state of the system, which is different from what you see in linear problems. In linear problems, what you'll see is some kind of partition of energy into the linear modes of the system. Here there's an instability of the excited modes. So I'll talk about a theorem joint with Avi Sofer on selection of ground state in nonlinear Schrödinger and also sometimes called Gross-Pitayevsky equations in the Bose-Einstein context. And then if I have time, I'll get to a particular problem of a particular Gross-Pitayevsky equation, namely one with a double well potential. Double well linear trap potential has a certain symmetry to it, and there's an interesting symmetry breaking phenomena that comes out, and it's an interesting, still open problem to understand the phenomena discussed here in that context. Okay. All right. So I'll start with linear resonance problems. Suppose we consider the linear Schrödinger equation. H is some Hamiltonian like Laplacian plus a potential. It could be a matrix operator. And suppose that the unperturbed problem, if I set W equal to zero, has an embedded eigenvalue in the continuous spectrum. So these are problems posed on all space. Okay. So there's energy could be confined in space, but it could also radiate out to infinity. Suppose the unperturbed problem has the property that there is an embedded eigenvalue in the continuous spectrum. If there are any questions, please don't hesitate to ask. I think I'll just use one. So the spectrum is written as follows. There's the continuous spectrum, sigma sub c, and then there's a point eigenvalue, just for simplicity. What happens if you turn on a small perturbation w? The perturbation is autonomous here. W is just a function of x, or matrix function of x. Then what happens generically is, and this actually goes back to around 1930 in formal, non-rigorous work of Weisskopf and Wigner, is that an embedded eigenvalue perturbs to, well, this goes away. It kind of dissolves into the, you know, as Friedrich said, I think it dissolves into the continuous spectrum. So if I look at the spectrum for the perturbed problem, HW psi equals E psi, then this has absolutely continuous spectrum. Where did the eigenvalue go? Well, if you study the Green's function, if you study the resolvent H plus W minus E inverse, the Green's function for this, then you look at you look at analytic continuation across the continuous spectrum, then you find that there's a pole near the axis. That pole is sometimes called a scattering resonance or a resonance pole. You can calculate in perturbation theory, if W is small, how far from the axis you are. The imaginary part of W is written as minus gamma, and, well, gamma is, I didn't write this down, but gamma is strictly positive. Gamma is strictly generically strictly positive, and it's of order w squared. So an eigenvalue becomes something called a resonance. In terms of the spectral problem, the mode corresponds, there is a solution to the eigenvalue equation corresponding to this complex number, w, and but it doesn't satisfy L2 boundary conditions because the operator is still self-adjoint, so you don't have complex eigenvalues, but psi does satisfy an outgoing radiation condition at infinity. And then similarly, if you do the analytic continuation in the other direction, then you get incoming. So psi is not an L2, in fact, typically exponentially growing. Okay. So that's a static spectral picture. If you want to think about things dynamically, you can say, okay, how does this resonance pole manifest itself in the dynamics of this equation? After all, the spectral theorem says that I just write things as a superposition over the continuous modes, right? I mean, that's all there is. Is there any kind of manifestation of that complex singularity? Well, a simple way to see it is as follows. If I take a general initial condition which is localized, say in the Hilbert space, L2, or actually typically L2 with some weight, then if I look at the inner product of the I should take the initial condition, say, equal to the ground state of the unperturbed problem. That's the simplest experiment. How does the ground state of the unperturbed problem evolve? So let's take psi of zero equal to this psi zero here. Then you can look at the projection of the solution for the full dynamics onto that state coming from the unperturbed dynamics. One gets basically a finite dimensional description, a damped oscillator. Okay, so and if you look at the energy of that oscillator, it decays exponentially. This description is valid for times of order 1 over the perturbation squared, 1 over w squared. There's some norm here that I'm not saying anything about. But the point is that this infinite dimensional problem of can be viewed in terms of some kind of finite dimensional normal form, and then there's a damping coefficient, which one can compute, sometimes called the Fermi-Golden rule, and you'll hear about this later in this and other talks. Okay, so this is the original context, one of the original contexts of the sort of resonance problems we'll talk about. Okay. Well, what about moving towards nonlinear problems? First, let's take a stop at linear parametrically forced systems. So now I'm going to take a system with many, many bound states, genuine eigenvalues, which are not embedded in the continuous spectrum. Okay, just say maybe 100, a Schrodinger operator of H has a potential which supports, it's a deep well, it supports lots and lots of bound states, say 100 of them. And what happens if you perturb by something which is, say, a spatially localized potential, which is either periodic in time, almost periodic, or random in time? And the question is, how does the energy distribute? If you look at the amount of energy in these states, how does it distribute? Well, this perturbation, because of the frequencies of WT, the bound states will interact with each other. They'll exchange energy. There'll also be some interaction with the continuous spectrum. And it's also possible for bound states to interact with each other through the continuous spectrum. Okay, so there are these higher order processes as well. And the bottom line here, there's Edward will say something a bit about this, is that, say, for example, in the random case, there's some damped behavior. Actually, I should have my pen here just in case. Excuse me. So you get some kind of damped diffusive behavior, okay, in the random case, but diffuses in the mode space, right? So if I think of P is the analog of the previous P, there you had only one eigenvalue, now here you've got 100 of them. So if I look at the amount of energy, actually P is really the expected value, in this particular case it's the expected value over realizations of the potential of the amount of energy, the intensity mod amplitude squared, amount of energy in mode K at time T. So the energy is diffusing and it's also being damped. And there's some effective equation that describes that. Okay, let me show you a numerical picture just to see what that looks like. So I don't know if that's clear up there. That upstairs here is the Schrödinger equation in one space dimension with a potential V which is has a single bound state. And then there's some parametric forcing, and if you just look numerically at the behavior of the projection onto the ground state, for the unperturbed equation, if I let delta equal to zero, then the amount of energy in the ground state just stays. Its energy all stays in the ground state, but if I turn on delta, there'll be some kind of characteristic decay in the maximum amplitude in the projection. It's actually smoother. And then this is a log plot to show the transient exponential behavior. If you wait long enough, then there'll be algebraic tails because of the dispersive character that takes over. Okay. Nonlinear problems. Well, nonlinear Schrödinger equations now. Okay, so now the W has a linear part and a nonlinear part. Nonlinear Schrödinger, or sometimes called Gross-Pitayski equation. Nonlinear Hartree models, where they have a non-local nonlinearity. And then equations of this sort, which are similar to in some ways to the Dirac equation. We call them often coupled mode type equations. These are first order equations which govern waves propagating to the right and to the left. There's some inhomogeneities in the media and some nonlinear terms, and I'll say where those come from. In these particular problems where we have some inhomogeneous potential, here V of X, here the potential is actually in these matrices, you think of a soliton or some kind of a pulse which propagates, and we're interested in situations where the scale of the solitary wave, basically the width of the solitary wave, is on the same order of magnitude as the scales of the inhomogeneities. So there is work on the case where you have a very, very narrow spike that's propagating through a medium quickly, and then what happens is if it's very, very narrow, then the inhomogeneities are just look like a flat medium, and then very, very little energy exchange takes place. But if the soliton that's coming in is of the same order of magnitude as the potential and sizes, then there'll be significant energy exchange, and that's what we're interested in. What's common to all of these problems is that there is some finite dimensional problem governing bound state-like behavior. There's an infinite dimensional problem governing radiative behavior. There's some decomposition of the full problem into something ODE-like and something dispersive PDE-like, which interact, and one is looking for some ways to general ways to analyze such systems on different timescales. Okay. So, in the context of nonlinear Schrödinger, let me just mention there's plenty of work in this area going back to the 60s and 70s by Either. I mean, there are a lot of names in the dot, dot, dots, and this is low-energy scattering with no bound states in the systems, just small solutions, translation invariant problems, work on stability of existence and stability of nonlinear ground states intuition and good calculations in the physics literature, which resulted in theorems. Probably the earliest ideas in variational stability, I like to go back to Boussinesq, whose work was made rigorous by Brooke Benjamin in the early 70s. And then more recently, a lot of work which interacts with that we use in our work on nonlinear Schrödinger selection of the ground state. So, okay. So that's just a partial list of things. Okay. So, how am I doing with time? Well, let me just say something about the problem of trapping of light. Okay, so here's a simple model here you have a waveguide, an optical fiber, for example, with some periodic structure along the length of it. You send a pulse of light in, and this light pulse has some envelope and some carrier, rapid oscillation under the carrier. It'll be governed by Maxwell's equations. Here's a model, 1D Maxwell type model. It's a nonlinear wave equation. The medium is captured by this refractive index, N, and N it has an expansion which has the periodic structure in it, but there's also a nonlinear part that says that the refractive index is large where the intensity is large. Okay. So-called Kerr effect. Okay. How does a pulse propagate through such a structure? It looks something like this. So this is a full simulation, okay, if you like. There are 80 to 100 oscillations underneath the envelope there. That's what E of Z and T is. And this is a situation where one's at or near the Bragg resonance. If you blew up the if you magnify the oscillations here, then in this particular simulation, you would note that the wavelength of these oscillations is roughly twice the medium periodicity. Okay, so there's some background periodicity, and we send a pulse of light. This is the initial condition for that PDE, if you like. And the wavelength under the carrier is roughly twice the medium periodicity. And then what happens is in that particular case, because you're at that resonance, there's a strong coupling of backward and forward waves. The wave equation supports waves going in to the right and to the left. And when the initial condition is tuned in that way, you see such coupling. So you see you see energy propagating left and right. But then, actually, because of the nonlinearity, without nonlinearity, this would just disperse to zero. You'd have energy propagating off in one direction and another direction, and also attenuating due to dispersion. But here, it reconstitutes itself because of the nonlinearity. There's some kind of soliton-like behavior, but it's not standard unimodal soliton behavior as you would see for the nonlinear Schrödinger equation. So one could develop in this situation an asymptotic theory using multiple scales. And the bottom line of that theory is a coupled system governing the backward and the forward and the backward wave amplitudes. And it satisfies these so-called nonlinear coupled mode equations, which have, as I said, some of the features of the Dirac equation. If I just threw out the nonlinear terms, and then you would see that E plus and E minus individually satisfy the Klein-Gordon equation. The mass term in the Klein-Gordon equation is this kappa, and kappa is the coefficient of the periodic function describing the medium, the background medium. Okay.
The previous numerical result for Maxwell equation.
Actually, for something called the anharmonic Maxwell-Lorentz model, but you can get shock behavior. Yeah, we have some dispersion in the problem there also, because that's where the Lorentz model comes in to give you the dispersion. Okay, there's some interesting analytic open questions there that we can talk about. Okay, so that's so notice that the you start with a periodic structure, and then what get the when you're near this Bragg resonant, when you're in this Bragg resonant situation of wavelength having twice the medium, being twice the medium periodicity, then the governing equations for large large and physically relevant timescales is a translation invariant problem with continuous translation invariants. Okay, and this turns out to have soliton-like solutions of the sort that you saw in the simulation. Now, if we're interested in trapping a structure, well, the proposal of Slusher from Bell Labs to us some time ago was, why not try to create localized defects in the periodic structure? So this is a blow-up of this of the refractive index as a function of space, and, well, why not try to modulate the periodic structure through its phase, through its amplitude, through its average? Okay, and these are all parameters that an experimentalist can tweak, you know. You can actually fabricate things to this. So these are like control parameters, parametric functions. And if you just do the asymptotic theory, then what comes out as envelope equations is, well, nonlinear coupled mode equations, but now with variable coefficients, which are potentials, like potentials. So this is like the Dirac equation with a potential. And one could look at standing waves and such things, and nonlinear bound states, et cetera, et cetera. And but the one thing that we looked at here was the scattering off of such defects for such scattering theory of incoming soliton. So a soliton comes in, say, from minus infinity, it encounters this localized defect. That's the support of the potential, and it can do one of a bunch of things. It can be reflected, it can be transmitted, or it can get trapped. So this is the sort of thing that we'd be interested in getting, is understanding, really, what does it take to trap incoming energy. So there's trapping. And one of the things that one sees if you spectrally analyze what the trapped energy is, that although the defect, the potential, can have multiple energy levels, and therefore, it turns out, multiple nonlinear bound states, the energy wants to select a particular state. There's a preferred state for the energy asymptotically. And so that's the analytic problem I want to say something about at this point. How does the energy distribute, the trapped energy distribute? Understanding the capture process, well, we've done some studies. There have been in various groups, there have been work on trapping of energy by defects. What I'll concentrate on here is how does the energy distribute for large time. So let's go back to the simpler Schrödinger model and ask that question. Just run a simulation. Here's the nonlinear Schrödinger equation with a potential. And this potential has that 4 there means that there are two eigenmodes in the linear problem. So, okay. So this problem over here, this problem over here, if I throw out the nonlinear term, there are two eigenfunctions, so that there are two independent time periodic spatially localized solutions. I could superpose them. I have quasi periodic solutions, and then there are radiation states also. If I initialize a superposition with equal amplitudes in the ground state and the excited state of the linear problem, then it'll remain that way, just quasi-periodic, because I can diagonalize the operator, and the oscillators are in the eigenbasis, they go independently. Nonlinearly, they'll get coupled, and what happens? Well, what happens is what I alluded to in the previous slide, and that is that if you look at the ground state, it begins to pick up energy, the excited state decays. So energy from the excited state is getting lost. It's going into the continuous spectral parts, it's going into the ground state. The total energy of the system is conserved, but there's some kind of an internal damping in the system. There's energy is running out of this into other channels. All right. So at this stage, I'm going to talk about an analytical result. So I want to talk about this asymptotic selection of the ground state. So first I'll set it up. So is this in the way? No? Okay. So let's look at the nonlinear Schrodinger equation. We'll look in R3 for a complex function phi xt. Lambda is equal to 0. The spectrum of H is taken to be continuous from 0 to infinity. And let's take two bound states, which are named E0 star and E1 star. And if I look at the solution, phi of t, for some general state, well, it's going to look like e to the minus E0 star t, psi 0 star. So psi 0 star is the state. Well, let me just write psi j, j star, summation on j, plus the propagator. P sub c is the projection off of the bound states onto the continuous part. So there's some coefficients here which depend on the initial condition. Phi 0. And this piece over here, decays. So we have that this is, say, L infinity bounded by t, say, in three dimensions, t to the 3/2 times L1 norm, under suitable conditions on the potential. So H over here is Laplacian plus V of x. So you think of some kind of a potential well. Let's assume that it's nice and smooth, as smooth as you like, and let's assume that there are a couple of energy levels in that well. So what you see is that for the linear problem, you have some kind of quasi-periodic behavior plus decay. And that's the general behavior. So now, if lambda is not equal to 0, the question is what happens? Now, to describe what happens, I want the analog of these states, the nonlinear bounds. I want the nonlinear bound states. So let's do the following. I want to seek solutions e to the minus I e t times psi e. So there's an elliptic problem that's satisfied by psi e. And I want psi e to decay at infinity. Okay. So this is the nonlinear eigenvalue problem. All right. And one has such states, which one can construct either variationally or by bifurcation theory, essentially the implicit function theorem. If I draw the axis e versus some norm, I won't specify which norm. It's not important for small amplitude. I'm going to look at the case of weak nonlinearity. So that I'm going to think of lambda as being either plus or minus 1, and I want the data to be small in some sense. I'll tell you more about the norms later. Okay. Just to plot what's going on here. So there are two eigenvalues of the linear problem. The linear problem is what takes over at small amplitude, and then there are bifurcating states. And I'm assuming that there's some level here, epsilon, so that things are small. Once the If this is the case, if lambda is equal to minus 1, and if lambda is plus 1, then they go the other way. If lambda is minus 1, then the nonlinearity just deepens the potential well and pulls the eigenvalues off to the left. The global behavior of this diagram is very sensitively dependent on spatial dimension and the norm that you use, right? If you go to large amplitudes, but at small amplitudes, any norm will describe it. Okay. I want a parameterization for this curve, so I'll introduce a complex parameter alpha. And so the curve is, so alpha is telling you, there's an invariance, the equation under multiplication by a complex number modulus 1. So there's a complex number with amplitude and phase. This is two pieces of information. And this says that the bifurcation is in the direction of the bound state, the linear bound states. Okay. So as alpha gets small, I'm more and more in the linear regime, and things look more and more like the linear states. But then the states get deformed in some fashion. Okay. So here are nonlinear bound states, in the context of linear bound states, in the linear context, we understand how bound states participate in the large time dynamics. Everyone plays a role. There's really no preference in this model, okay? And the question is, how do the nonlinear bound states participate in the large time dynamics here? Alpha j is a function of, I mean, epsilon is just the really going to be the size of the data, if you like. So, alpha j will be of size epsilon, will satisfy some bound in terms of epsilon. But this is just a description of the family of solutions of this equation in terms of a parameter alpha. This, the bifurcation curve. It's just a parameter, right? So I could throw out the dynamical system, the initial conditions. I could just look at this elliptic equation and show that there are solutions of this structure. Okay.
For lambda equals 0, alpha j equals 1.
Oh, okay. I'm fixing lambda. Okay. See, some people vary the coupling constant. I'm fixing the coupling constant, and I'm changing the norm of the solution. All right. So how do these bound states participate? Well, a little bit is known about these things. For example, there is a variational approach to the study of the nonlinear Schrodinger equation, which is really to write down a Hamiltonian. A Hamiltonian is roughly like this. And then there is the L2 norm, and one can construct a ground state as the infimum of H subject to fixed N. Okay. let me just assume that I'm looking at small data here. That's important, because then issues of criticality and come into play. But so if I'm at small data, this always, if theta is small, this always has there is always a minimum, and then the minimum corresponds to exactly this curve over here. So I can either construct solutions by the implicit function theorem, by bifurcation from a simple eigenvalue, or alternatively, I can realize the ground state branch as a minimization. Okay. Both give a construction of the same state, but this has the advantage of that dynamical stability as a consequence. Okay, so I know that the ground state branch is dynamically stable. I don't know, though, that it's asymptotically stable. The kind of stability that this implies is H1 stability, sort of energy space stability, which is, in terms of a finite dimensional Hamiltonian picture, it's just saying that if you start in a neighborhood, well, you stay in a neighborhood of the state that you're interested in, but you don't necessarily converge to it. We're interested in the scattering behavior, in whether you actually collapse onto either a quasi-periodic state or a or something which is not quasi-periodic, and we'll show, in fact, that the behavior is quite different. So here's the difference from the linear problem. So the theorem is the following. So roughly stated, so I take phi0, which generic small data, then there's a number gamma, okay, which is analogous to the gamma that of the linear problems that I mentioned, and gamma is a perfect square, and it's roughly the Fourier transform with respect to the operator H, the continuous part of the operator H of the following vector. It's a some frequency omega star. Omega star is equal to 2e1 star minus e0 star. Okay, so this is perfect square. So the assumption is that this is strictly positive. This will generically be strictly positive. Okay, this is all this says is that nonlinearity induces coupling of bound modes with continuum modes at second order in perturbation theory. Okay? That's right? So there's a perturbative it says that certain harmonics lie in the continuous spectrum. Okay? So these are taken to be real. I mean, the linear problem, I just take the real states, but yeah. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, and then there are various background hypotheses on the operator H. The potential V has to be a potential, V has to be a potential which doesn't have any zero energy resonances. There are all kinds of technical things. And then, but the conclusion is that you have an asymptotic ground state. So t goes to infinity, you have phi of t looks like an asymptotic ground state plus order t to the minus 1/2 decay. Okay. So two differences. First, let me just say what this is a little bit more mathematically, that there is some So just to contrast, so first of all, what's emerging is something which is dominantly a periodic state. You just see the ground state. You don't see the excited state. The excited state is decaying. That's in this eta. And the decay rate is t to the minus 1/2. So instead of something quasi-periodic, you get something asymptotically periodic. Instead of something that decays like t to the 3/2, you get something that decays t to the minus 1/2. And So the phenomena at work is some kind of nonlinear resonant coupling between this finite dimensional bound state system and the radiative part of the solution. Yes. You can make an expansion. You can distinguish between the two of them in that the other bound states sit there and die, and there's a radiative part which actually is outgoing at infinity. Yeah. Yeah, there are components of both the radiation and the bound states which decay at that slow rate. At that slow rate, yeah. Mm-hmm. Right. So a corollary of this is a non-persistence of the quasi-periodic state. I'm not going to say something about there are non-generic initial conditions where one can construct states which are asymptotically like the excited state. Okay, just like you have the existence if you can have something like a finite dimensional unstable manifold, where you actually realize unstable states in vector time. So, there's a way to construct those as well. That was done in its entirety by Tsai and Yao, regarding the construction of non-generic states. Okay. The same result. It's a small data result, so the sign of lambda is not important. The only thing I change, if lambda is positive, is that the bifurcation curves do this. Right. However, the global behavior, the large data behavior, which is really not touched by this analysis, is very much affected by that. Because if lambda is negative, then if I take very large initial conditions, then it's possible to excite a genuine soliton that moves off. Whereas in the lambda is plus one, there are no solitons. So. Lambda equals plus one, therefore there's more of a hope of analyzing that problem at large data in the short term than the lambda negative case. Let me say something about why How does one distinguish, how does one see the difference between the ground state and the excited state? Okay, this is not a gradient flow. Okay, you don't have something like flow towards least energy as you do in parabolic problems. So what distinguishes the ground state from the excited state? So I'll give. There are two ways to think of it. One way is related to the approach that Edward will discuss in his talk. Another approach is a spectral theoretic. Perhaps relates to I think what Scipio was going to talk about. Suppose one looks at linearization about the ground state. And you contrast it with linearization about the excited state. So remember, the ground state, the nonlinear ground state, is psi alpha 0. And the nonlinear excited state is psi alpha 1. And one can write down Hamiltonian system for the linearized perturbation about each of these states. So, for example, I can look at the following. The linearized evolution is an equation of the form, write it like this, maybe z dot is equal to j l z, and then the question is, what's the spectrum of j l for the ground state case, and what's the spectrum of j l for the excited state case? And roughly the story goes as follows. In the ground state case, which we know by other methods is stable, we know what the spectrum has to be. It has to be on the imaginary axis if it's nonlinearly stable. And it looks something like this. There is a zero eigenvalue because of symmetries in the equation. And then there are a couple of neutral eigenvalues which are related to the excited state. In the excited state picture, so now we linearize about the excited state. Well, again, there's a zero mode. But you have, under the conditions of the theorem, which is this that omega star is see, in order for this to be non-zero, it's necessary for omega star to lie in the continuous spectrum. I mean, it's captured in this parenthetical remark. So there's an instability in the imaginary part is roughly gamma. The way that relates to the embedded eigenvalue problem is that if you linearize about the excited state and then move back towards zero amplitude, then what you have is a problem with embedded eigenvalues in the continuous spectrum. This condition, this arithmetic condition that it's strictly positive, ensures that there are embedded eigenvalues in the continuous spectrum, and these we know will typically dissolve. Now, in a Hamiltonian, in a self-adjoint context, an embedded eigenvalue, because of conservation of energy, will perturb to a resonance. But linearization about the excited state is a non-self-adjoint problem, so it can perturb either to a resonance or to a genuine eigenvalue, genuine instability. So this is a instability that you often see in Hamiltonian systems, but it's related to this departure from the continuum. So this is something that distinguishes the excited state from the ground state. You see that there'll be some kind of instability, and this actually will show up in the nonlinear analysis. So let me just make some comments about the proof. And that is, first let's decompose the solution into natural coordinates for small data. So for small initial conditions, we're going to, instead of using linear amplitudes, evolving the amplitudes of the bound states, we'll use the natural nonlinear amplitudes or curvy linear coordinates. This coming from those bifurcation curves. One gets a coupled finite infinite dimensional system. So this is roughly the structure. One derives equations by a projection procedure, actually related to an approach of Buslaev and Perlman, Buslaev and Sulem. Equations of evolution for alpha 0, alpha 1, and for eta. So this is the finite dimensional part. This is a finite dimensional, these are oscillators coupled to a fluid, a dispersive wave field. And one has to analyze this system. So the idea is to make explicit the resonant interactions that take place between these two subsystems. Okay, so basically what one does is one solves for eta to high enough order as a functional of alpha 0 and alpha 1, as you, in the spirit of, is what you do, for example, in dissipative problems, you try to solve for the dissipative part as a functional of center manifold coordinates. The problem here is that everything is center manifold. Everything is on the imaginary axis. And then you want to substitute eta plus dot dot dot, this functional of alpha 0, back into alpha 0, alpha 1 system, and reveal the essential dynamics. Okay. Well, the next part is just summarized by normal forms. In other words, many near identity changes of variables. Okay. And the structure of the system, if I define, yeah. Yeah, let me, so if I define Q0 of t, which is up to near identity changes of variables, something like alpha 0 squared, and Q1 of t, alpha 1 of t squared, then we have a system of the following type. So dq0 dt, so this is the finite dimensional part. Oops. I'll write it with inequality just to show you the part which actually matters. I want to tell you what the dot 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 is. Maybe I'll say what that is right here. So the dot dot dots have to do with, are dominated by coupling to the radiation part of the solution, coupling to the eta. So, and I'll describe them as follows. They are things that look like, they are things which are estimable in terms of a high norm, something which you expect to disperse on the initial conditions, and then parts which involve local decay norms, and a singular local decay norm. So. Okay, so sigma is sufficiently large. And remember this omega star. Omega star lies in the continuous spectrum. So this is some Green's function, which is singular. You take the limit in the complex plane. And this is omega star is strictly away from the threshold, away from the endpoint in the continuous spectrum. And, well, heuristically, you could see from stationary, non-stationary phase type methods that you would expect this to decay very rapidly if you're spectrally away from the endpoint of the continuous spectrum, and then near the endpoint of the continuous spectrum, this is bounded, so it'll just be a stationary phase. So, okay, well, So these are the correction terms. This is how the coupling to the radiation comes in. And then, so this is essentially the normal form. Now, but it's not the end of the story because you have these terms over here. Okay, so if Q0 is not large, see, it's possible that the excited state is larger than the ground state initially. Okay, in that case, this is a big term. So what we'd like to do is neglect that term. If we neglect that term, then the dynamics are very, very simple. They're just, this is the phase portrait. And you see collapse onto the ground state because this system over here, if I take the system with equality, then I see that Q0 plus 2Q1 is a constant, just adding the equations, multiplying this equation by 2 and adding them. So I have this flow from the excited state down to the ground state. However, this doesn't dominate on all timescales. So I have to show that I get to this regime where this takes over. So there is an intermediate timescale where this kind of behavior dominates. So I want to... So that's three... There's not much time left. Oh, I have two minutes. Right. Oh, I went over. Oh, okay. Yeah, all right, so, sorry about that. Okay, so, oops. Okay, so I'm going to end it by not doing the calculation, but just saying that there is an initial regime where we don't say much, but we have an a priori estimate on the behavior of the solution. We suppose we're in a situation where there's a finite time where this condition gets violated. If it ever gets violated, then the ground state is decaying. If it gets violated at some point, then what happens is a Q0 over Q1 begins to grow by calculating the evolution of the quotient, the ratio of energy in the ground state to the excited state. One can show that this begins to grow. Q1 might be very small, might be much larger initially, but eventually this actually grows exponentially. Q0 takes over. Once Q0 gets big, this term can now be estimated by terms like this, and then you're in the regime where the ground state is selected, as in this phase portrait. So that's where the analysis is going. So I'll stop there.